Hello, world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 197. I'm creator and host Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered his talents to do work he loves, to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Perry Marshall. Welcome, Perry.
Welcome. It's really special to be on your show, and I love the subject of your show. Boy, if you can't find something passionate in what you do, oh, God help you, you know? So let's just get on with making it happen. And I think one of the themes that's probably going to come out is find your passion in the rubble somewhere.
Right.
I think people have a kind of an excessively romantic idea of what it means to find your passion. And I think that could be very disappointing. But somewhere, there's a pony in there somewhere.
Precisely. Precisely right. So a quick question to you, Perry. Are you using your talents doing work that you love?
I am. More and more so. What a gift to be able to do that. And I hope that I steward it well. And every day I have fascinating conversations with fascinating people, and I'm able to help people and be in my talent zone. And if you got to move heaven and earth to make that happen in your life, it's worth it.
Yes, it is. Well, we want to hear the whole story. Perry Marshall is an author, speaker, engineer, and world-renowned business consultant in Chicago. With a decade of research, he brings a fresh perspective to the 150-year-old evolution debate. Bill Gates of Microsoft and the founders of Google revolutionized software and the internet through their status as outsiders. Similarly, his book, Evolution 2.0, harnesses a communication engineer's outsider's perspective to reveal a century of unrecognized research and discoveries. Evolution 2.0 resolves the conflict between Darwin and design, opening new avenues of science research and raising tantalizing new questions. So, Perry, that's a pithy summary of your career to date. Tell us what you're working on now that has you engaged and excited.
Well, Evolution 2.0 very much has me engaged, and it's not merely for the purposes of ideology. I mean, I think everybody knows as soon as you bring up the whole Darwin evolution creation topic, everybody's like, oh, here we go again. We're going to go around that merry-go-round again. And really, what I am working to do is take it in a different direction, because what it at its cutting edge, it is a multidisciplinary field that brings together engineering, biology, computer science, mathematics, business, philosophy, religion, and a whole bunch of other ancillary fields. And I think this is the most exciting time to be alive. There are incredible discoveries being made. There are very daunting questions. And I have a little piece of the postage stamp to bring to it. And it's been really gratifying to see people starting to come out of the woodwork, supporting what I'm doing and really bringing some harmony to it. And so hopefully this will make sense as we go forward. I am just very excited about this.
Good. I'm sure it will make sense. Well, as you know, everyone's life is composed of turning points. The developmental people tell us that happens every 6 or 8 years, where we take a look at ourselves and we are faced with choices and changes and chances and make decisions that move us on to the next turning point, good, bad, or indifferent. So take us back in your storyline, if you would, as far back as you want to go, and talk about the more memorable and impactful turning points in the life of Perry Marshall.
So one turning point was when I was 17, I decided to major in electrical engineering, and it was because I was intensely curious about, I was designing and building stereo equipment. In fact, I had a business. I was selling speakers through a local dealer, and I had the stereo business going, and I knew that I only understood it at a surface level. And I thought, you know, if I got an electrical engineering degree, I would really know this subject down to the bedrock. And I got that degree, and I did know it down to the bedrock.
Where did you go to get the degree? And tell us about that.
I went to the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, which was where I grew up. I couldn't afford to go to any place fancier, but it turned out to be a great school, and I specialized in control systems and communication systems. And when I got out, I could do what I set out to do. I couldn't really explain to you, it's like, why do you need to know this at such a deep level? And I was like, I don't know. I just have to. I just know I have to. It's kind of this very gut level thing. And there was satisfaction in it. So let me tell you about another turning point. So I get out of school. I moved to Chicago to take a job as a speaker designer. I worked at Jensen for a few years. I designed speakers for Mazda and Ford and Chrysler and Acura. And then I got laid off from my job. And this turns out to be a very important turning point. So I'm 26 years old. My wife is 3 months pregnant. I get called into this meeting. All you people are being laid off and I have to go find a new job. And without moving somewhere else, I can't find an acoustics job. And so I go into a technical sales job and I end up selling factory equipment, which is nothing to do with audio equipment, but it does have to do with digital communication. Mm-hmm. And this was like one of these, it was a major dislocation. First of all, the sales job was brutal. It was bologna sandwiches and ramen soup. Really, it was a disaster for a couple of years. And we went really deep into debt. And I ended up having to get another job because I got fired from the first one because it wasn't doing well. But then that job started working. And it started working for a couple of reasons. One of them was because they had a place where I could start to use the direct marketing skills that I had been learning on the side. And the other reason was because what I was selling actually, in an odd and interesting way, it was networking equipment, and it did go back to some of the stuff that I had gotten in college, and I understood it. And this was one of these situations where it took a while, and it was a real struggle. But after a while, my inner geek started to see how cool this was. And it did not happen overnight. This is why I told you that this is like find your passion in the rubble. Mm-hmm. I kind of got shoved way out of my comfort zone and I'm doing this other job, but I found something fascinating.
Let me get the story thread right. So you got the technical sales job, didn't work in bologna sandwiches. But then you said you were able to use some of the direct marketing experience you'd learned on the side. Explain that just a little bit.
Okay, so the sales job that didn't work was pound the phone, get an appointment, go see the guy, and it was just horrible positioning. The new job was in 1997, and the company had a website. And I had discovered, not too long before, I had discovered a whole universe that we call direct marketing, which is, it's not you chasing them, it's them coming to you, it's catalogs, it's direct mail, which eventually evolved into most of what people do now to do internet marketing.
Yeah, it's what HubSpot pioneered too, right?
Exactly. It was that kind of thing. And right. I was ahead of the curve on
you were very much marketing
stuff, which... And the reason I was ahead of the curve was I had to find something better than pounding the phone. It was killing me. And so I go to this new job and they got a website and engineers are using the web sooner than everybody else and our customers. And we figured out, okay, you put really quality content, you help them solve their problems. They're going to send you emails, your phone's going to ring. And so we start helping these people solve these very specific networking problems. And so not only did I understand the marketing, but I also understood what they were talking about on the technical side. It was the kind of job only an engineer can do.
Yes, yes.
And every single day I'm talking to these guys about, should I use this kind of network or that and these kind of packets or those kind of packets? It was very technical and I was loving it. It was so good. And I got my first like actual real commission check and, you know, we started to get out of debt. And so it was really great. Well, so eventually we sold that company. I got some stock options. I parachuted out. I started a consulting firm. I started doing marketing consulting and I wrote an Ethernet book because one of the technical publishers said, we really love your magazine articles and we need an author. And so I wrote this book called Industrial Ethernet, which at the time it was like, boy, I don't know. Is this a waste of time? It was really hard to write. And the way I write, like, it has to make sense. It has to be simple. It has to be really digestible. And it was a lot of work digesting it. I mean, you pick up any Ethernet book, they are so boring. And I'm like, I have to make this interesting. Well, so is this going to do me good? Well, it did. It helped my consulting career. on the marketing side, because people knew that these companies would read this book and they go, this guy knows what we do. Mm-hmm. He knows exactly what we do. Well, so here's another interesting, and I could have never foreseen this. So fast forward another couple of years. I've written this Ethernet book and I'm going along and I'm running my consulting business. I get an argument with my brother about evolution, okay, which I didn't know anything about, okay? But like we grew up in this really super conservative Christian environment. He got a seminary degree. He moved to China as a missionary. 4 years later, he's almost an atheist.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And we're arguing and he's kind of dragging me with him against my will. And I'm intuitively, this is just not making sense. However, he's asking really good questions and he is really smart. I mean, he's amazingly smart. And I go, hey, Brian, okay, look at the hand at the end of your arm. That is an amazing piece of engineering. I said, you don't actually think that this is like the result of a bunch of random accidents, do you? And he goes, hold on. He goes, yeah, actually I do. And then he explains the whole Darwinian evolution thing. And he goes, Perry, you're wrong. The biologists are right. Most biologists would disagree with you. They would agree with me. You don't know what you're talking about. And this is how the world works. Okay?
Good.
Now, I knew when he said most biologists would disagree with you, Perry, and they would agree with me, I knew he was right. And I knew I didn't know. And I knew how subtle and counterintuitive engineering can be, science can be. I mean, somebody should make a YouTube channel of just counterintuitive things in science, you know, right? And like, dude, you do not know. Okay. And I knew I have to find out. I am going to find out. I am going to get to the bottom of this. And you know what? If this makes me into an atheist, so be it. But I'm going to find out, like, can you really get a hand after a series of random mutations and natural selection? So I go down the rabbit hole. Now, if you know me, if you know my customers, if you know the people, entrepreneurs and like people, we are obsessive. And I went obsessively after this. I eventually bought about 200 books and read them all. I read hundreds of scientific papers. This is 11 years ago. Okay. And I just start going down the rabbit hole. Well, for a while, I was completely lost. And I would listen to one side and they would say something, it would make sense. And then I would go over to the other side. And I decided, I'm going to listen to both sides. I am not going to bury my head in the sand. I'm not going to pick a position and just hunker down. I am going to go as deep as I need to go, anywhere I need to go. And I'm not going to ignore anything. And so I just totally, and I would go from one side to the other and I'd just get more and more lost. It's like, they both seem to be saying right things. They both seem to be saying wrong things. How do I figure this out? And one day I was reading about DNA. I was trying to understand how mutations work and all this. And suddenly I had this lightning bolt of realization. And here's what it was. DNA is digital code, just like Ethernet is digital code. And it didn't take me long to see that the data structure in DNA is scary similar to the data structure in Ethernet.
Wow.
In fact, there are so many things in common. Like I could make a list of them and I could go, da, 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 da. This matches to this. This matches to this. This matches to this. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I can understand this now because I understand code. I understand digital communication. I spent years getting a degree about this stuff. I understand it. I used to talk to customers about this every day, all day long. I get this. Now, there's differences. I totally acknowledge that. But there are some basic things in common. Guess what? Evolution is a software engineering question. I can figure out how this works because look, if you look up the definition of evolution, it says mutations of DNA, which produce these changes, which then are filtered by natural selection to get the winners and the losers. That is a statement about the software. That is exactly what they're saying. I can figure this out. Well, now it all started to make sense. And I started to be able to put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. and go to very bedrock truths. I could analyze it mathematically. I could analyze it in the way software engineers do, and I could start to figure out how it works.
Wow.
Well, this eventually led me to what is the most fascinating science story that I have ever seen anywhere. And it is largely untold. And so here's what happened. I quickly figured out that the standard common textbook explanation of evolution, which was random copying errors of DNA, like it occasionally gets copied wrong, and once in a while one of the miscopies is actually better, and then natural selection just picks the good ones and it kills the bad ones, and then nature gets better and better and better and better. Now, that makes lots of sense to lots of people. It sounds very plausible. And not only that, you have all of these fossils and all this genetic evidence that supports an evolutionary story. But, and this is a big but, the randomness part could not possibly be right. And I knew that. Ethernet and all communication systems, all through your computer, all through your cell phone, they are loaded with error detection and error correction mechanisms. So you don't even think about this, but you're driving down the highway and you're talking in your cell phone, or maybe you're a passenger and you're on your iPad and you're surfing the internet. You have no idea how many times that signal is being resent so that it gets to you correctly. It's getting put back together at the other end correctly. If something is missing, your iPad goes, send me that again. And it's got layers and layers of error correction and error detection. And that's the only reason it works. It would never work any other way. And whenever you break the signal with any kind of copying error, it just destroys everything. And nobody knows this better than a communication engineer. And I said, okay, there's no way that copying errors would make DNA better. So what's going on? And then I found like a whole gold mine of literature where cells have error correction, error detection, retry, resend, all the same stuff that your cell phone has are in cells. In fact, weeks ago, there was a brand new Nobel Prize awarded in 2015. And you know what it was for?
No.
It was for the three levels of error detection, error correction, and repair of DNA inside of cells. Exactly the same thing I wrote about in my Ethernet book in 2002.
Good heavens.
Same thing. Okay. And this is a key to understanding cancer. Because most cancers are the result, 50% of cancer is the result of a certain gene being deleted, and it's the gene that kills the cell when there's a copying error. So what your cell phone does when you're driving down the highway is it gets a bad packet. There's a mathematical calculation that says, that's a bad packet. Throw it away. Send me a new one. Okay? Cells do the same thing, but the throw it away command, it's an abort replication of cell command. It's like start over, ditch this cell, make a new one. Cancer, 50% of the time, is when the instruction to delete gets deleted. Okay?
Wow.
So now you have a cell that replicates, and it's got bad code in it, probably multiple sections of bad code, not just one thing. And it starts replicating, and it's full of bad code.
Wow.
And none of the cells that replicate after that will kill themselves either. So you have a tumor growing out of control because of a copying error. And then there's something else that's going on top of that, which I haven't even talked about, and here's what it is. The cancer cells start evolving. Cells are capable of evolving. They have the machinery to do it. And we have known this since the 1940s. And this is why evolution happens. So let me tell you a little story. In the 1940s, they still hadn't really figured out DNA. They knew about chromosomes. They knew about genes. They knew about heredity. They hadn't got it all figured out. There were lots of geneticists. They were working on stuff. And there was this lady named Barbara McClintock. And she was kind of a loner. And most people were working on fruit flies and bacteria, and for some reason she was working on corn plants. And she liked corn plants because between her advanced microscope skills that she had developed, and she developed some very useful techniques that were brand new in the field, and she could also look at the patterns of the colored corn kernels on corn maize, And between all the different things she was looking at, she could figure out what the genes were doing. And she figured out a way. She damaged a chromosome in this corn plant, and she wanted to see what it was kind of going to do. And she thought like a hacker, like in the best sense of the word, like, I'm going to hack this thing. I'm going to see what this thing does. And so she damaged one of the chromosomes, and it had missing material, and it couldn't reproduce. And what the plant did totally surprised her. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before. The corn plant went into a cycle. It's very technical. I'm not going to go into the details, but it went through the cycle of trying to fix these chromosomes, and it started moving genetic material around, and it eventually repaired a broken chromosome and resumed its ability to reproduce, even though what it needed to begin with had been damaged and lost. Okay, so what you had here, to use a computer analogy, you had a computer program where part of it was deleted and it repaired itself. Think of it like if somebody ripped a page out of a mystery novel, if they ripped out page 183, and then you gave it to a writer or an editor and said, fill in the missing page as best you can. Mm-hmm. And like a really good writer could probably pull that off. This is what the plant did.
Good heavens.
Now, what she had done without initially realizing it was she was the first human being to observe a creature evolving in real time and actually understand what happened. Because she figured out what happened. She said, okay, this moved over to here. This moved over to here. These things moved around. And she called them jumping genes, and they're known as transposons. And all these genes started moving around and changing the expression of other genes. And like she saw this happen, and then she was very meticulous, and she had a furious work ethic, and she pursued this, and like she mapped all of this out, and she called these mobile genetic elements. So here's what happened. That was late 1940s when this happened. She eventually pulled all of this together and into a coherent thesis, and she presented a paper at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in 1951, and she showed all these guys what was going on, and you know what they did? They laughed at her. Like half of them laughed at her, and the other half were just mad. You know, like, this woman actually expects us to believe that a plant rearranged its own chromosomes? Like, are you crazy? Plants can't do that. Everybody knows that. And like, they just threw cold water in the whole thing. And so what happened was she pretty much went underground with this for the next 20 years. And she didn't really publish very much about it, but she kept working and working and working at it. And then in the 70s, people started confirming, yeah, this really happens. In 1968, a guy named Shapiro confirmed that bacteria can do this. And she won the Nobel Prize in 1983.
Oh, my word.
Well, what I just described to you is just a tip of the iceberg. And what I just described to you, this is why you have to finish your antibiotics and kill the bugs dead. Because if you don't, they will self-adapt. And here's the thing. See, this does not happen accidentally. I knew within 2 months of my evolution research, there is no way these mutations are random. There's no way any of this is accidental, because it would never work. It would never work in any other digital system. It would never work in a computer. It would never work in a cell phone. It would never work in computer software. And this is not how it, so what's going on here? What is going on? And it took me a long time to find this. I mean, this was not obvious. And especially 10 years ago, it was not just laying around. For the only way you could figure this out was if you were willing to go to wade into PhD or even postdoctorate level stuff. Like, it just wasn't what people were talking about, certainly with lay people. And there was, I call it in my Evolution 2.0 book, I call it a Swiss Army knife with five blades, where there are five distinctly different systems that cells use to adapt to situations. And they do it based on hundreds of inputs from the environment. And nobody is telling this story. And if you go to the bookstore if you go to Barnes & Noble or someplace like that, or if you go to all the popular titles on Amazon and you buy an evolution book that's written for the mass general public, there's basically only two kinds out there. A, there's creationist books that say evolution is a hoax, but it's not. Okay. Barbara McClintock proved that it's not. And you can get large evolutionary events, not just small ones, and you can do them in the lab. If you know what you're trying to do, you can produce a new species. Okay. And there's lots of people that know how to do it. Okay. So, you know, there's this whole set of creationist literature that's like, evolution's a hoax and all this. It's like, well, no, it's not. But the evolution books, none of them actually tell you how it works. In fact, almost all of them essentially are atheist propaganda. And they own, in fact, if you read a book by Richard Dawkins or Jerry Coyne or Bill Nye, it is a study in the assembly of propaganda. And propaganda is always about what are they not telling you. Mm-hmm. Most propaganda is true up to a certain point. Sometimes everything the propaganda tells you is true, except there's a whole part they left out. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the evolution books, every time you find the word random, you have to cross it out and replace it with the word systematic and structured and goal-directed. The cells are trying to survive. The plant is trying to survive. The plant is trying to reproduce. It will sit there and it will cut, splice, edit, rearrange its DNA until it figures out how to do it. And nobody was telling the story. Nobody in the popular press. Now, there were books and articles and things at the PhD level. And actually, what I started to find out was that what a practicing professional biologist, how they conceive of evolution is very different from what the public hears. And I said, I have to tell this story.
Yes.
So I spent 6 years writing a book.
Good heavens. That's truly amazing. I can't wait to read this book. How long has this book been out?
3 months. Just came out.
Excellent.
It's called Evolution 2.0, Breaking the Deadlock Between Darwin and Design. And when I talk about breaking the deadlock, the Darwin skeptics are right about a lot of things. But the Darwinists are right about a lot of things. So looking at the two sides and scouring the propaganda and figure out what's true and what's not, what can you verify and what can't you verify, and where is there an experiment and where are they just guessing? It was like this meticulous surgery, just going through this and figuring out, okay, keep this, throw away this, keep this, throw away this. And then it's like slowly these two sides started to come closer together. And then when you filled in the missing story that I just told you, mm-hmm. all of a sudden it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so what you find out is evolution of organisms is actually remarkably similar to the evolution of jazz or coffee shops or politics or art or cell phones or software or automobiles. There's some very consistent patterns that you see over and over and over again. And most people actually understand evolution better than they think they do, because we all have to evolve every day. We evolve our careers. If we develop products, if we're writers, if we're musicians, you know, we're constantly borrowing things from over here and reintegrating them. And it's a lot of work.
Yes.
It doesn't happen by accident. You know, you have evolved this podcast.
Right.
Out of every 100 things you try, only 15 actually work.
That's right.
Well, welcome to evolution.
Right.
Nobody gets to be lazy for long.
No. Well, congratulations big time on this epical work. I'm really looking forward to reading this. So what if the statistics say, let's take your work and your theories here, and let's put them into the workplace, to the fact that the majority of people around the world, according to Gallup and many others, are not in their sweet spot. They haven't fully evolved, if you will, to use their talents and their abilities and their values and their skills to do work that is, it's always a work in progress, as you just described for 20 minutes. But yeah. Why is it that you're able to get to your sweet spot? You have some serious obstacles here. As you described early in your career, you worked through those obstacles and you came up with changes that worked for you and you kept evolving. Why aren't people more than not able to do this? What is that about?
There's a Brian Tracy-ism, if you know who Brian Tracy is.
Oh, of course, of course.
You know, eat that frog. And it's like, what's the most distasteful thing? Well, do it first, get it out of the way. And I found with all of these things, there were two parts to them. There was the part I loved, but it was always came along with a part that I hated.
Okay.
I'll give you several examples of this. As I began to figure this out, I started to fall in love with the topic, but I hated the way it was being abused in the marketplace of ideas because there was all this stuff that was being said that I disagreed with. Okay. So I started to get into the conversation that's happening out there, and I started engaging on my blog and, you know, some discussion forums and things. And now I encounter people with zero manners, right? And I mean, you could type in Perry Marshall idiot or Perry Marshall atheist or something like that, and you'll find thousands of websites that people that hate Perry because I'm taking a stand on this issue. And there was a lot of ugliness, and it was like the good and the bad were always mixed together. And like I had to get through the tough part.
And how did you?
Well, mostly it was from a sense of conviction that I just needed to, that it was the right thing to do. Like, I can't believe how badly science is being abused. And by the way, so I'm a Christian, and yes, there was a religious element in this. However, it wasn't the religious part of me that was offended at what was being said out there. It was the engineer in me that was offended. These guys are peddling junk science. Mm-hmm. And please understand, there's a lot of things they're saying that are actually very true, but it's indiscriminately mixed with a bunch of stuff that's most emphatically, clearly not true.
Okay, this is perfect. Stay with the issue of all those folks out there, the 87% that Gallup says can't answer that they're using their talents every day, and the 70-some-odd percentile that – and these are hundreds of thousands of interviews over several decades. So
yeah. As
a scientist, there's got to be some currency to this. So what is it about people – you said a very important thing. You said eat that frog. You love what you do. You hate what you do. You ate the frog and move forward out of a sense of conviction, a very strong conviction. Okay, so if the listeners around the world are listening to this interview, they know you're a super bright guy that's doing some great epical work. How do they find that little piece or that big piece in themselves? How do they find that? How do they get to that? How do they listen to that inner voice that is the source of conviction? What do they do?
Okay, so you have a place where your talent, whatever it is, addresses the toughest problem at the deepest end of the swimming pool.
Okay, beautiful.
Okay,
beautiful.
And it's the deep end of the swimming pool, which is where you need to go.
Okay.
And a lot of times the shallow end of the swimming pool is fun, but like nobody's going to pay you to solve that problem. What they're going to pay you to do is solve the hardest problem that nobody's been able to solve. Now, there's an exercise. I think a lot of people, they don't really know their talents. This is almost always true. Most people do not clearly see what their unique contribution is because they're too close to it. Now, here's an exercise that will solve it. And this is an assignment for everybody. What I want you to do is like pick 10 people that know you really well from several different dimensions of your life, but they've known you for a long time. And I want you to send them an email, and I want you to say, hey, you know, I was listening to the Growth Podcast and they gave me an assignment. I need to ask you a question. What do you see as my most unique capability that I do better than most other people? Just tell me what you think.
It's a great question.
Okay. And you send that email to 10 people. Now, first of all, you're going to be in a good mood the next couple of days when those come back because you've given somebody permission to tell you how good you are, which oddly is something that most people don't seem like they have permission to do.
Yes.
It's like more acceptable to insult people and criticize people and correct people than it is to say you're awesome and you know why?
Yes.
Like how often has somebody walked up to you and said, hey, Don, you're awesome. You know why? You know why you're awesome, Don? And they look you in the eye and you feel a little sheepish and like, well, what? You know what? You want to hear it, right?
Right.
You've given them permission to tell you something good, you know? And then they say, well, you know, Don, one of the things you do better than anybody is you really slow down and you really synchronize with people and you ask them deep questions and you really want to know. And most people I talk to, they just don't do that. But you do that, Don. Or, you know, they're going to say something like that, right? And so you take your 10 pieces of feedback and then you mix them all together. And it's like, okay, so I heard this 5 times. I heard this other thing 4 times. I heard this other thing 6 times. I heard this other thing 3 times. What are the patterns that emerge over and over? And then you start to work it out. What I did when I did this exercise is I really took some time with it. And I actually reduced it down to there are 6 things that Perry does. And I'll tell you what they are.
Good.
I deconstruct, I invent, I evangelize, I write, I teach, and I encourage. Okay. Those are the 6 things that Perry does. That's what came out when I emailed my friends. That's what came out of it. Well, and in fact, I got each of them down to 1 word.
Hmm.
Well, if you can get your core talents down to 6 words or 6 phrases, then you can grade every single thing that comes along and you can go, well, if I take that job, most of the time I'm going to be using 2 or 3 out of the 6 things. If I take this other job, I'll be using 5 or 6 out of the 6 things. And the 5 or 6 is exponentially more powerful than 2 or 3.
Yes. I'll tell you, where did you come up with that very nice idea?
I kind of stole it from Dan Sullivan of Strategic Coach, and okay. I need to give credit where credit is due.
Okay.
And I adjusted it a little bit, but that's essentially the essence of it. And this brilliant exercise, and really, you ought to spend a few hours on it. It's really worth doing. And then you go, okay, so how can I take these 6 virtues and talents that I have to the deepest end of the swimming pool and solve a problem that nobody else is willing to solve, understanding that solving this problem is going to be difficult and ugly and unpleasant, but there's going to be a victory on the other side. You know, everybody wants to be Frodo at the end of Lord of the Rings when he throws the ring into Mordor, but he doesn't really want to fight the orcs, you know?
Yes, yes.
You got to fight the orcs. I mean, it's going to happen. And I think 87% of people don't really accept this, and they just medicate themselves by watching Luke Skywalker or Frodo have a victory in their life or some football team instead of having their own victory.
Yes, exactly. We could talk for a couple of 3 days here. Now, this is truly great. You were right at the top of the conversation. This is really wonderful. What do you see, just briefly, because the show is coming to an end, regrettably, what do you see in the next few years going forward in the life of Perry Marshall? What's your vision going forward?
One of the things that I really want to do with my life is heal the rift between science and religion. And that is not something that can be done at a 100,000-foot sweeping level. That is something where the devil is actually in the details.
Mm-hmm.
And I advocate a view of science that the world is testable, it's discernible, it makes sense, it's repeatable, that nature and everything in it will reveal themselves to you if you pay close enough attention to them. You don't have to go get ridiculously mystical, but I believe the world is the way it is because God made it that way. And so, like, it's not an either or, you know, it's like science or religion. No, no, no. That's like saying particle or wave. It's like, yes, like it's all an integrated whole. Okay. It's not this war. Like, this war between science and religion is all made up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessary. In fact, it didn't really exist until about 150 years ago. There wasn't a war between science and religion. So, like, for example, probably we've all heard the story of the Queen told Christopher Columbus, you're going to sail off the edge of the earth, so no, I'm not going to fund you.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. She didn't think the earth was flat. Neither did he, and neither did anybody else. Nobody thought the earth was flat back then. A guy named John Draper made up that story in the 1870s to make Catholics look stupid. Okay, they just thought the New World was a lot farther than Columbus thought it was. And so, like, that's just one example. And I think we really need to be reverent and respectful to, like, this is not just an academic question, because we now have the ability to edit genomes. We now have the ability to move that code around, but we only understand 10% of it. There's people out there telling you that 90% of your DNA is junk, and they want permission to fix it. It's not junk, and they do not know what they're doing. You would not let a 14-year-old with a screwdriver into your Ferrari engine. And now, I'm not against scientific progress here, but I'm saying, whoa, we do not understand this very well. We barely understand this. We don't have nearly enough respect for it. We can't even fix ourselves. If we're going to try to fix nature, I think there's a lot of hubris in there, and people need to be very careful because you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
So in a sentence, what are you proudest of?
I'm proudest that I managed to create a business life that gave me space to work on projects like this. I worked on this book for an hour every day for 6 years, six days a week. And fortunately, I have a business and a lifestyle and a company around me that gave me a little space to go do a skunkworks project that nobody could pay me for that cost a lot of money. And I hope that so many more people will do things like that. And it can only come from passion. You know what? You're going to have a love-hate relationship with your passion project. You are going to have a love-hate relationship with your passion project. It's going to be like a stormy lover. You hate her one day, you love her the next. I mean, look, that's what it's going to be like. And you got to wrestle the thing to the ground.
Perry Marshall, what a great pleasure being with you today. Thank you for sharing the highlights of your amazing journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. How do those listeners get in touch with you?
You can go to cosmicfingerprints.com and you can get 3 free chapters of my evolution book. And if you're interested in the business side, go to perrymarshall.com and you can find my books on Amazon. So I hope to hear from people and post a comment or whatever, and I'd love to hear from you.
Good. Listeners know you can go to discovertalentpodcast.com and to our put in Perry's name and find the highlights of this illuminating interview along with the links. I want to thank listeners across the world for listening today. You know, we have an ebook, What Do Highly Successful People Actually Do to Succeed? 12 Proven Career Building Strategies to Help You Do What You Love. Perry's described many of those strategies today. I hope you'll take advantage of it. It's free. It's a Kickstarter for your life and career at whatever age you are. You can also subscribe for free on iTunes and Stitcher. We'd love to have you be a member of our tribe and tell us how we can serve you better with shows and guests and content. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We do not learn them. We cannot ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive. We thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.